It's a great pleasure to be with you here today at the Council of Europe to discuss the relationship between achieving democracy and increasing ethics in our societies. First, let me say that the organization that I represent, the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, is an educational foundation. We exist for just one reason, which is to develop and disseminate internationally the knowledge of how to use nonviolent resistance as a way to struggle for rights, for democracy, for justice, for self-determination, and for other important achievements that the people wish to have in their societies. To me, in somewhat of an Aristotelian sense, ethics is very simple. It means ascertaining and doing what is good. Doing good obviously requires power, which gets us to politics. And so I think that the use of civil resistance by people whose rights are denied may well be a natural way of developing and using power in pursuit of what is good, which is to say, their obtaining of their natural human rights. Now, we know that ethics is not simply a matter of ends, which is to say, those conditions we wish to achieve in our society, but is also a function of the means we use to achieve those ends. Gandhi has said that it really isn't possible to achieve ends by means which are inconsistent with those ends. And that would suggest that nonviolent action is intrinsically ethical if it's preferable, if it's better, if it's good, that one's means for engaging in a popular struggle are nonviolent rather than violent. What I'd really like to do in the next few minutes is to make sure that we have a common understanding of what nonviolent resistance, or as Europeans usually say, civil resistance, what it really is, what the core dynamic is. Because I think we might agree that the mainstream news media, which covers the most obvious form of nonviolent action, protest, often doesn't get the fundamental ideas straight when it's engaging in that coverage. The ideas beneath the formation of civil resistance as a form of political action were originally developed by individuals such as the French thinker and writer Étienne de la Boétie, who was a friend of Montaigne, Henry David Thoreau, the great American dissenter in the early 19th century, Leo Tolstoy, who many of you probably know, in addition to having been a novelist, was also a passionate campaigner against conscription during the time of Tsarist Russia. Mohandas Gandhi, in the first decade of the 20th century, was well aware of Tolstoy's writings and used those writings as well as ideas that he was gleaning from having observed the use of nonviolent action in the first Russian Revolution in 1905 and in Irish resistance to British rule to develop his ideas about nonviolent action. Originally applied in his leadership of the movement for people of color in South Africa, and then subsequently in resisting British control of India. The methods of nonviolent action that he used, he actually referred to as nonviolent weapons, being not at all reluctant to frame the use of nonviolent action as a struggle, as a conflict, in which one was attempting to develop political power in order to achieve rights. In the case of Indians, freedom from the British Empire. Many of those nonviolent weapons that he used, you're familiar with, we're all familiar with, mass marches and protests, the refusal to pay taxes, boycotts of products, in his case, sold by the British, resignations from government agencies and bureaus by those who wish to side with the people's movement, even active interference and obstruction with the state if the state was imperial or oppressive. The American scholar Gene Sharp at Harvard University in the last 40 to 50 years categorized all those tactics of nonviolent resistance as either protest and persuasion, such as petitions and symbols and marches, tactics of non-cooperation in which the people withdraw their support and active involvement with the oppressive power, which could be a military invader, not simply a dictator, in order to be able to cause difficulties for that oppression, or tactics of direct intervention, such as blockades and seizures. The core dynamic when we use such tactics, when the people, when movements and campaigns organized to seek rights used such tactics, is very simple. The people, through these actions, deprive an oppressor or an invader, or whoever it is that is responsible for withholding or blocking rights, the people deprive that authority of its legitimacy by withdrawing their consent, by suggesting that when the state says that it has the consent of the people, if it's oppressive, it's lying, it's not telling the truth. When you face a liar and you tell the truth, you're doing something to the liar's possession of legitimacy. All governments, all those who abuse rights, wish everyone to believe that what they're doing is legitimate. So that's dissolved. Then when enough people participating in a movement do refuse to cooperate with these abuses, they increase the cost of accomplishing those abuses. They increase the cost of maintaining oppression. This isn't petitionary action. It's action, in fact, to degrade the power available to an oppressor. So when the system's legitimacy goes down and its costs go up, what history shows is that even those who are enforcing its orders begin to doubt whether it's sustainable. And then what often happens is you see that apparatus of control dissolve. That's the fundamental mechanism that occurs when you see these radical shifts of power as a result of what a nonviolent campaign or movement engages in, as we saw in Tunisia and Egypt. The record of nonviolent resistance in the last 100 years is really quite breathtaking. In a recent study done by two academics in the United States reviewing 323 violent and nonviolent insurrections in the 20th century, they found that in about 23% of cases, violent campaigns for liberation could be said to have been successful in some phase of its operations, but that in the case of nonviolent campaigns, the success rate was over 53%. Not something that you would imagine based on the historical record, much less based on the media's reporting of campaigns and movements today, which suggests that there are some misconceptions about the relative effectiveness of nonviolent resistance, which is to say that the recent increasing number of such movements is not an anomaly. What's anomalous is the fact that globally we're noticing them and we're learning from their lessons. In establishing democracy, this mechanism of popular civilian-based power has been successful. In the 35 years between 1970 and 2005, there were 67 transitions in the world from authoritarian to democratic control. And in 50 of those 67 transitions, the key factor was some form of coalitional nonviolent force that was developed by political parties in opposition, by a mass movement, by some kind of common effort summoned by those who wished to restore the people's rights. In my judgment, when this happens within a society, there are a number of conditions which are imparted to the society which undergoes this form of change, which actually make that society both more sustainably democratic as well as ethical. The first idea which is modeled as a form of action by a nonviolent movement is that of consent, which is to say, the individual transfers his or her consent from a system that he or she recognizes is not legitimate to a movement, a campaign, or a new force for democracy, which they believe has more legitimacy. And so power is created not by the application of violent force, but by the simple act of transferring consent and cooperation. Think about what that does to the ideas about action and what's effective in a society after the change. The next property which, or condition which can be imparted to a society is that of the very idea of reason. You cannot organize a nonviolent movement consisting of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or millions of people by forcing people to join such a movement. It has to be voluntary, which means you must present an argument through reason. You have to persuade people to join. You have to respect their minds. That means that you also have to be honest. All these values are implicit in the organizing and mobilizing of a nonviolent movement and are modeled to all those participating in a nonviolent movement. The third property or condition which is imparted to a society by nonviolent action is the instinct as well as the experience of self-rule. Gandhi used the Hindu word Swaraj to describe this. He actually said to Indians, how can we expect to rule our nation if we cannot rule ourselves as individuals? That means we have to learn how to plan. It means we need discipline. It means we need unity. We have to learn to organize ourselves. All of these are not simply activities, they represent political values which are important in maintaining both an ethical and a democratic society. The next condition is representation. No movement is successful unless it ascertains and represents the people's grievances and interests. That means leaders of a movement have to listen to the people. They have to have humility. They have to invite participation. They cannot force people in their movement to take a certain action without persuading them to do so. That's representation, which, as we know in a democracy, is a key concept to understand and practice. What movements also need to exhibit, which also is modeled to the society, is resilience, sustainability, the capacity to continue to do something until it's successful. Nothing is simple, as we know, in democratic politics. And the largest reforms typically take the longest through parliamentary action. This is exactly what happens to movements before political freedom has been achieved. Mobilization, action, even in the streets, staying at the work of resistance year after year and decade after decade takes the norm of faith and dedication, commitment to the movement's values, and just the sheer desire to see it be successful. All these are really abilities of citizenship in a democracy. This is also, of course, a change which is actually not accomplished by revolution. I think that's the wrong word to use with respect to what we see in places like Tunisia and Egypt. Even though emotionally it feels satisfying to use that word, we're really talking about transformation. Transformation of a people, of a society, and therefore of the way in which they govern themselves. And that process teaches those who engage in movements and campaigns that the adversary, and there is usually an oppressive or rights-denying adversary, is not monolithic. It's not a gray bulk of a system. It's comprised of people, many of whom find their way into the new order and learn how to achieve even a political living in the new order. In fact, many of them in the life of a movement are typically pulled over to the side of a movement. So there's no such thing as monolithic enemies, or shouldn't be, in a democracy. The mode of politics moves from destroying your adversary to debating with your adversary. And then when the change happens, one finds that everyone has become a stakeholder in that change. The leader of the coalition that defeated Augusto Pinochet, the dictator in Chile, in 1988 in a national plebiscite, said, after several years of engaging in a nonviolent campaign just to force those in power to create the plebiscite, said, how many Chileans the day after this was successful could say that they had done it? 7 million could say that they had done it. Not a violent revolutionary vanguard, not a heroic leader, but everyone had done it. So struggle as a means of achieving power, which we know has been with us from time immemorial, has recently found a nonviolent methodology to express itself. The demand for militant struggle is still universal. There are 40 to 50 countries in which serious conditions of oppression exist. I think the methodology of this struggle is summed up in many ways: the ethic of it, the power of it, and the ability to summon popular force behind it is summed up in a single sign that was held by a single protester in 1986 on a street corner in South Africa by someone who was engaging in the struggle against racial injustice and apartheid in that country. And the sign simply said, to end violence, struggle for justice.
What?
And I think she meant to end violence of all kinds, the violence of the state, the violence of those struggling against the state, the violence we do to ourselves when we lose patience and we believe we've exhausted our means. We have not exhausted our means. The people themselves possess those means, and they themselves can achieve justice. Thank you.